Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. Before we start the show, how does the offer of free beer sound to you? Kind people at Beer 52 are offering a free case of 8 craft beers, sourced and curated from the best breweries on the planet. All you need to do is go to www.beer52.com/Wisden and cover the £5.95 postage. Each case is delivered directly to your doorstep, so there's no need to leave the house. Head to beer52.com/Wisden for that deal. You can pause or cancel your subscription at any time. Anyway, on with the show. The men's international summer ended rather abruptly on Friday morning when the fifth and final test of the England-India series was cancelled just over a couple of hours before the scheduled start. We'll be discussing the cancellation, we'll be pointing fingers, working out if this really is the death of Test cricket, before talking about England's T20 World Cup squad, the final England-New Zealand T20I, the latest developments in the Azeem Rafiq story, Afghanistan's possible tour of Australia, the county championship, and much more. I'm Yaz Rana, and today I'm joined by the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker, the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, and the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner. Before I ask these three about their thoughts on the Manchester Test, let's hear from Mark Butcher, who was up in Manchester on that crazy first morning. I spoke to him earlier today. Butch, it was a chaotic morning on Friday. You were there in Manchester hoping to cover the Test match for Sky. Do you want to run through how that morning unfolded from your perspective?
I kind of got up and ironed a shirt and got myself ready and was just putting my jacket on the back of a chair at breakfast at about 5 to 8. When I got a phone call from producer Rob Noonan saying, get yourself to the Indian team hotel now. And I'm kind of like, whoa, okay, what's going on? He said, they're not coming. the game's not going ahead. So I hastily grabbed a coffee and put it in a takeaway cup and jumped in a cab and went over to where the Indian boys were staying. Got out of the cab, went into the hotel foyer, and there's nobody around. It's like tumbleweeds. There's a lot of security and from the hotel around, but no players, none of the usual hubbub that there would be, on a Test match morning. And then went and found the two guys, the Sky Sports news presenter and cameraman, who were stood outside. then we stood there on the street corner for a good half an hour, 40 minutes, because no one had a statement yet. We knew there was one coming, so we were all just waiting for that statement to drop. It did, and we read out exactly what came from the ECB in terms of what was happening. And in that statement, it had, that India had forfeited the last Test match, and, therefore the series would be 2-2 or whatever. So we read that out verbatim. And I reacted to it. And then 5-10 minutes later, my phone's going completely berserk with Indian fans abusing me for all kinds of things, mainly about my parentage, to say that, how dare I talk about the series being forfeited? Because, of course, unbeknownst to me, who's now in a Costa coffee shop at this time, the statement had been changed to remove the words forfeit. So, you knew then that the wrangling behind the scenes was going on in terms of what was going to happen to the status of the series, whether they were going to have to reschedule the match, all of that kind of stuff. So it was a pretty hectic morning. So the broadcast went on air at 10 o'clock as normal. And then they came to me again, sort of, I'm standing outside of the hotel room. I've got people coming up to me asking me if it's where Ronaldo's staying. What is that? Why we're there? And I bumped into quite a lot of England fans who by now had obviously heard the news and traveled up from all over the country, who were obviously desperately disappointed. So, and that was that. So my day was done by about sort of 10:15. I was heading back to the hotel to pack my bags and get back on the train at Manchester Piccadilly.
I found out about the news when I was on the train. We'd just passed Milton Keynes, and there was a lot of debate about whether or not people should turn back. There have been extreme reactions on both sides, a lot of finger pointing. One of your former England teammates saying that the IPL is killing Test cricket. Do you understand why the India players were reluctant to play?
Yeah, look, I don't think it was the right thing to do, right? Let's get that absolutely straight. But I don't agree that it was the IPL what done it, Governor. Because let's face it, the IPL was a factor, but that wasn't the reason why they decided not to play the Test match. I mean, after all, these guys have been on the road for crikey, probably about 18 months now. And in bubbles, they've kind of sacrificed all kinds of different things to play Test match cricket. Virat Kohli has almost single-handedly kind of, which might be overstating the case, but sort of has, hold on. Jack Blatherwick's having a bowl. It's kind of, you know, has rekindled the sort of the love and importance of Test match cricket in the biggest cricket playing nation in the world. So, you know, that decision would not have been taken lightly. You know, again, if you want to point things at the IPL, these guys, most of them are all millionaires, goodness knows how many times over. They're not bothered about the money for missing, you know, maybe the first game or two. I think they just absolutely had a gutful of bubbles, of quarantines, of being, you know, of being at risk of catching COVID. It's obviously in their camp. And, you know, the thought then of having to do another 10 days of quarantine before you're able to leave just was too much to bear. And I'm pretty sure that that was what played the main part in their decision. Now, none of that is of any consolation whatsoever to the vendors and to the people whose businesses are kind of geared up for 5 days of Test cricket to Old Trafford, to Manchester, to Lancashire County Cricket Club. None of that is of any consolation to them at all. But having been in bubbles and done quarantines and all of these types of things over a much shorter period of time than they have, I can completely understand how they got to the end of their rope with it all.
At the start of that answer, you said that it wasn't right. Is that more the timing of the decision?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of sort of, I wasn't speaking in terms of morality. I just think in terms of, you know, they could have played the Test match for sure. Or they could have got it started. They could have got it underway. I don't think anyone would sit here and say, you know, I wholeheartedly agree that the decision they made was the correct one. That's not the case. But what I can say is that I can completely understand how they came to that decision. Mm. You know, the people sort of, you point back to, oh, hang on, big shout, no wicket. You point back to, you know, England's decision to leave South Africa, you know, back before, was it before Christmas? You know, the circumstances there were different in that England had no positive tests in the group, but no one was vaccinated. There was no such thing back then. You know, South Africa, there were no crowds in the ground, so there was no, you know, it might not have felt to them as though they were letting people down particularly, because there was nobody there anyway. I mean, this is very different on so many levels, because of the fact that it was, you know, the back end, the final Test match of what should have been an incredible series, was an incredible series up to that point. There were lots of people who had bought tickets and whose lives had been arranged around this 5 days, and to find out that it wasn't going to go ahead at the very last second was devastating to all of them. So, but look, I'm pretty sure it was done with a heavy heart from the point of the Indian team. I mean, just think what they've lost in terms of, you know, the historical context of what they might have achieved in terms of winning three Test matches in England. And carrying off the series. And as I've said, these are guys who have made a hell of a lot of sacrifices to be attempt to be the number one Test match team in the world. And they wouldn't have taken this decision lightly.
Mm, absolutely. Anyway, we'll let you get back covering the Somerset Lancashire game. Good to see you. See you soon.
Good to see you. Take care. Bye.
I think it's worth running through the chain of events first. So initially, three members of the India coaching staff tested positive for COVID early in the week. A fourth, a physio called Yogesh Parma, tested positive on Wednesday, 2 days before the scheduled start. A Telegraph report stated that a group of India players contacted the BCCI on midnight before the game, expressing their desire for the game not to go ahead. On Friday morning, there were rumours circulating the game wouldn't be played. The ECB then released a statement saying that the game had been cancelled and that India, it had in effect forfeited the test. Within minutes, all references to a possible forfeiture were removed. The result of the game is still yet to be determined. The BCCI have reportedly offered to play a test in England next summer, as well as or instead of a couple of extra T20Is. Phil, it's a lot to take in. What are your thoughts on the cancellation?
I wonder if you were going to come to me. What are my thoughts? My thoughts are, overridingly, what a terribly sad way to end what should have been a great series, which is now broadly undermined, forgotten about. Your heart goes out to the many, many thousands of people who would have based their weekends around that. People who have booked hotels, people who have taken time off work, people who have bought, you know, ridiculous costumes and all the rest of it. And in the end, yet again, and you see this in sport increasingly, I think, that the punter, the person lowest down on the food chain is the one who really gets it in the neck. And my heart really went out to everybody who was gearing up for this game. It should have been a fabulous finale to what has been a really good series. And in the end, it just feels besmirched, to be honest. And the apportioning blame side of things, well, we can all tie ourselves up in knots here. But one thing is for sure, the ramifications, both financially and diplomatically, are monstrous. Lancashire released a statement saying they're devastated. They'll be devastated on all kinds of levels, but the balance sheet will be devastated. Tom Harrison's valiant attempt to try and persuade us that this wasn't a COVID cancellation, but this was a cancellation determined on the mental health damage caused by the threat of COVID, and hoping that Mr. Insurance Man was going to be listening to this. That was you know, a classic of the genre, really. And I sympathy for Tom Harrison doesn't come naturally to me, especially when him and his mates pocket 2.1 million in bonuses with a game going through a pandemic and on its knees financially. That said, I did feel for him a bit on the Friday morning, because he was having to deal with the mother of all shit shows here. And they know that if it's a COVID cancellation, then the insurers aren't interested. And if they can somehow persuade the insurers that it's not, that it's something else, then they have a chance to recoup some of their losses. The impact that it has on the ECB and the BCCI's relationship going forward, God only knows, but it won't be a good one. And the impact that it also has on the Ashes as well further weakens what's already felt like quite a precariously balanced set of chain of events, if you like. If we felt like the Ashes was under threat a week ago, then it feels like it's under even more threat now.
Is that just because players possibly feel emboldened a little bit more to take matters into their hands? Because this came from the players at the end of the day.
I think exactly
the boards were keen to get the game ahead.
I think exactly that. I mean, pass it round to the table. But I think players living in these unique situations, unique scenarios, and India's players, core players, and England's core players, they've been flogged from pillar to post now for 18 months, right, through this pandemic, compared, say, to Australia's men's team. They've hardly played any cricket at all. Now, in these unique scenarios, in these unique situations, you can understand why players are increasingly breaking away from the conventions and the party lines and saying, my tether has been reached and I can't go any further. But that is a broader point than the specifics of last week.
Joke, on the specifics of the cancellation of the Test match, do you understand where the Indian players are coming from?
I do, absolutely. And in my view, if the roles were reversed, England would have been on the first plane out of Mumbai. I think it's a slightly different situation with South Africa in that vaccinations hadn't arrived then, so it's not a direct comparison. But we have seen that England were prepared to quit a tour early because they didn't feel comfortable in that environment, as was their right. They took a bit of criticism. Lots of people understood. And I think we're in the same situation now. It's one of those debates that's brought out the worst on both sides. I've sort of steered clear of Twitter on this one because it's easy to pile into India at this point, and you've got the IPL, which so many people hate and so many people are angry about anyway for some very justifiable reasons. And I'm not naive enough to think the IPL has had no impact on this whatsoever. I'm sure it has. But you can, taking that to one side, they still were well within their rights to pull the plug on this one, because this wasn't just someone who was part, it wasn't a kind of a data analyst. This was someone who's kind of putting their hands on them as their physio, as the second physio. I don't know what they'd have done if they had gone through the match and needed a physio. I guess you just bring someone in into the camp, which I guess is not the worst thing ever, but there's got to be trust involved with those guys as well. So I think, yeah, it's all too easy to say it's India. India run the world. India ruined the series. There's loads more at stake. And it feels absolutely right. I mean, now when you, with the benefit of hindsight, it feels like everything has been building up to this point. This was the kind of pressure cooker environment for not just the Indian camp, for international cricketers across the world. And player power is incredibly strong these days anyway, particularly with the IPL and franchise cricket. And now I think players are going to feel well within their rights to say, I'm not comfortable, I'm not going to do it. But if you're piling into India, I would just wait and see how the next few months play out, because there are going to be some England players who don't fancy playing some cricket series as well.
It has been a good week for Ravi Shastri's book publishers. this is an interesting one, because it's assumed that he contracted it at that event, It was a big event, the number of Indian players there as well. It was a London event, his book signing, book launch. And some of the anger, frustration from the English camp stemmed from that sense of irresponsibility, of arrogance perhaps, of being laissez-faire and taking the notion of responsible living, if you like, in a COVID light bubble, taking it to the nth degree and actually jeopardizing this kind of delicate ecosystem. That's all very well until you find out that Tom Harrison was there as well.
But I don't think it's that straightforward, because in the Evening Standard report that broke that story, it stressed that Tom Harrison was not impressed with what he saw when he was there, and the ECB were surprised at how lax the COVID regulations were when they were there.
That was all said after the event as well.
That's true.
Was he at the time, or how unimpressed is he now? But there was also Malcolm Conn, the former Australian media manager, tweeted that Shastri had basically kind of flaunted advice during their series as well, refused to wear a mask at different points. These are all allegations, but there is that sense that he thought he was above the rules. But, you know, we've also been on this show saying that people need to have lives. They shouldn't all be in bubbles. So where do you draw the line? And perhaps a book launch is beyond that line, but it's easier said than done to just be like, right, that's wrong. Something else would have been right. I think Shastri, again, is an easy target here.
And I think you can also like think that there might have been mistakes made along the way, and that, you know, the book launch could have been more COVID safe, whatever. And also, we don't know, that's what you call it. But yeah, that could have been more COVID safe, and that the decision could have been made earlier, and it all could have been enhanced more sensitively, and still completely understand the decision that India have come to. I mean, like, and it is very different, sort of like learning to live with something which has been with us for 18 months, and then it all of a sudden being like right on your doorstep. So you can be living sort of naturally, and all of a sudden, I mean, in a similar situation, if you had like a housemate that tested positive for COVID, you would all of a sudden be like, it would just be a new feeling of like fear and worry. That's something you'd kind of been like pushing to the back of your mind, because that's the only way you can kind of live at the moment, basically, is to either be scared every moment of every day, or to sort of like make some sort of compromises. But then those feelings change when situations change. So I completely understand India, and I think India's move. I think there's also a way that, as much as it's hugely regrettable for the fans who are going to go, for Lancashire, for the ECB's finances, there is a way that positives can come out of this. I think that overall, players feeling they have more power to assert themselves, to sort of ask for better working conditions, essentially, is a good thing. And if this is what encourages England's players to say, no, we're not going to play the Ashes unless we have these things in place, that is good, because they shouldn't be asked to work in the conditions that they have been for the past 18 months. Basically, that has just been unreasonable, and we've kind of like boards and administrators have got away with doing it because players almost haven't felt that they've been able to assert themselves. If it does give them a bit more assertiveness, that is a good thing. And on what you said, Phil, about the relationship with the ECB and the BCI, in some senses this will weaken it, but also this gives the ECB a little bit of leverage, and the BCI, you know, the power brokers in the world game, if there is that bit, that could be a good thing for English cricket, for world cricket possibly. I mean, I remember Mark Butcher on an episode of this show, a while ago, was saying that like when India initially asked that this test be cancelled back in May, he said the ECB should have agreed, but on the condition that
they play in the 100.
Yeah, and why not bring that up again now? So like, fine, yeah, we'll have Virat Kohli for 3 weeks next year.
But that also doesn't take into account, we're talking about player power. You can't ask the BCCI to agree for all of their players to play in the 100. The players have got to make
sure,
those decisions themselves.
But right?
There
is
other things you can get. I understand the leverage argument.
But you can get them to opt to agree to offer no non-objection certificates, I guess, which is what the BCCI don't give at all at the moment. So I guess you could then let Indian players have the option of playing in the 100.
Yeah.
Or a game next year or something. But like that bit of power rebalancing could also be a good thing, at least for the ECB in the long run.
Phil, Ram asks, isn't it ironic that people say India are killing Test cricket out of this one incident when they've been one of the biggest ambassadors for the Test game over the last 12 months?
Well, I was just about to say, actually, on the back of Ben's point, if you take ourselves back to early December, maybe late November, I think early December, when they played that first Test match in Australia, in brackets, got bowled out for 36 and still won the series. But if you take it back to that point, it was touch and go whether that series was going to go ahead, certainly in front of any kind of crowds in Australia. They played four Test matches there. They legged it home. They played an ODI series, or rather a T20 series, an ODI series, then they played, they went straight into a 4-test match series against England. Then they played the IPL, which was cut short, as we know. Then soon enough, they were over on a plane at the start of May to tune up in English conditions to play the WTC Championship against New Zealand. Then they were in English kind of open prison for what, 6 weeks?
About a month,
certainly 4 or 5 weeks building up to that first test match. Play another 4 games. It would be harsh in the extreme to throw the book at those individuals who have given, for our enjoyment, our pleasure, and for the other not insignificant issue of keeping the cogs whirring of a game that is financially desperate. It would be, you'd have to have a pretty... Look, I can understand where people are coming from. I can understand the existential threat that they think the IPL poses. And I can understand that there is something at play regarding the sanctity of the 5-day game, which feels, again, like it's been chipped away at. But I can't subscribe to that perspective, because I think the bigger point is that India, who can call all the shots, have decided over the last few years, under Kohli's captaincy in particular, to throw everything they have at test match cricket. And you can't say that at other governing bodies. And there are reasons for that. There's real politic reasons. There's bottom line reasons for why the West Indies put on few test matches and so on and so on. But just looking at India, taking this week out of the equation, their players are the most compliant, hardworking players. For all their money and all their fame and wealth, they are the hardest grafting players out there. And just in terms of air miles, time on the park, every single sinew put into it, you can't throw the book at them.
Slightly cheeky question: do you think their decision would be any different if the series scoreline was different?
No, I don't think so personally. No,
I mean, it's a cheeky question. We are completely guessing.
But also, I guess it's also linked to what Phil said earlier in terms of how this series will be remembered, because kind of the series was perfectly set up in a way. If India win that 4th test match, the way the series remembered is completely different.
My inclination is to think that maybe they wouldn't have gone home if the score was different. If it was tied or if England were winning, maybe they wouldn't have. But I guess that's from seeing how desperate Kohli is to win over here, and I know how much that means to him. It feels like, not in necessarily a kind of cynical way, but you would just feel different about the environment around you. So, Ben, why do you think they would have headed home, whatever the scoreline was?
Well, I think partly because, I mean, they would have headed home knowing there was a threat that this would end in them not winning the series, that there would just be this forfeit. And as much as it would seem silly for England to, you know, essentially not lose at home because of a technicality, we're also in, you know, when this team comes to be remembered, you would, like, for example, that Pakistan series in 2006, we don't think of that as being like 2-0 or kind of 2.5 to the half to Pakistan when the game was forfeited for the ball tampering thing. We think of it as being 3-0 to England, and it's only when you actually click on the score can be like, how did England win having conceded a 300-run lead? Oh yeah, right, that was that game.
But they had already won the series.
Sure. It's a bit different.
But I agree with the fundamental point that they haven't won the series. They were 2-1 up with 1 to play. And so this obsession that Kohli has with defeating the two big old enemies, or the modern old enemies, now they don't play Pakistan. There's a huge asterisk that's right through the middle of the series
which will bug him. And I do see that. I think that makes sense. I'd be fascinated to know what Kohli's thinking was during this, whether he was one of the players who didn't want to play, whether he was trying to convince players who didn't want to play that they should play. That would be fascinating fly on the wall stuff, which I suspect we will probably never find out.
But yeah. just on Kohli, I mean, it's because it's quite, because he's obviously a figure of dislike among a lot of England fans. It's easy to see him as this very like ultra modern type player, this kind of child of the IPL, this white ball superstar who's kind of like, you know, acting out on the field and, you know, making fun of the Barmy arm, that sort of thing, and think of him as a player who would like actually in some ways not care too much about test cricket or care too much about the result. But that's not just at all the case with him. Like we know from you've interviewed him, Joe, and he is either very, very convincing, or he does absolutely love Test cricket, and that could easily not be the case. And you get a lot of players who sort of pay lip service to the long format, who say sort of like, yeah, it's the pinnacle, but you know, I'm just happy to play for my country, whatever thing. And that's not at all how it comes across for him. It does really seem like Test cricket
is. You
just
have to watch him for 30 exactly. seconds.
Yeah, clear, and if it weren't for him, Test cricket would be in a much, much worse place now. It is so much more relevant because the most powerful, one of the most powerful sports people in the world sees this thing as the ultimate pinnacle and will kind of do anything for success in it. And that does have to be remembered.
Mm. Yeah, I would imagine he'll be pretty. He'll have a cob on the journey home because he'll be thinking this is unfinished business. Throwing it forward though to what might yet happen. So the report in the Daily Mail this morning, Lawrence Booth, is that they've given the option, as you said at your intro, is it an either or? It's two T20s or a final Test match.
Apparently, both options are on the table.
Both options are on the table, but from what I read, Ganguly is. Pushed for it to be a one-off Test match rather than a continuation of the series.
So, yeah, so the series is won by India, effectively.
That's what he's pushing for. Yeah,
and then this is.
But the result of the Manchester Test match, the ICC might decide that it was a India forfeit. So, I think that this series, the 2021 series, is finished. We just don't know the result of it. If that makes sense,
right.
If there's a Test match next year, it's going to be a one-off Test match.
So that's
what Tom Harrison is also saying as well.
So there's no chance that Test match will be the fifth Test?
At the moment, no.
Sort of Schrödinger's Test series. Yeah. And also, who knows what this means for the World Test Championship as well?
We've got another couple of years to worry about that. Moving on, England have announced a 15-man squad for the upcoming T20 World Cup, as well as three travelling reserves. That squad is Morgan, Moeen, Bairstow, Billings, Butler, Sam Curran, Jordan, Livingston, Milan, Tamal Mills, who hasn't played for England in 4 years, Rashid, Roy, Willie, Wokes, Wood. The three travelling reserves are Tom Curran, travelling reserve specialist Liam Dawson, and James Vince. Thoughts on that group? No huge surprise in there, I guess. We're all collectively gutted for Matt Parkinson.
Yeah, I think so. Cricket vs. Freddie Wild made an interesting point that squad construction can be slightly different in these times, in that because you get to go with these travelling reserves, you can your squad doesn't have to be built so much around sort of covering for injuries as it sort of was during the 2019 World Cup. You needed to worry about what happened if Adil Rashid rolled an ankle on the morning of a game. Whereas now, so that particularly comes into play with Wokes, Willie and Curran, I guess, who all fill very similar roles as sort of like new ball bowlers who bat sort of at 7 or 8 and are kind of all-rounders with bowling all-rounders. You could easily get away with one or two of them in the squad, and that's where you fit in your sort of your conditions bowler. So that would be Matt Parkinson, I think, because you do get, you get in World Cups in general, but it's in the UAE, you get games and pitches where it does just really turn. I mean, in 2014, I think we had Harath take 5 for 3 to bowl New Zealand out for 60, and then the next World Cup, you had, I think, New Zealand spinners take 9 of the 10 or 8 of the 10 India wickets between them.
It's when they dropped all their quicks.
Yeah, exactly, and played 3 or 4 spinners. And England just don't have that option. They have Livingston to bowl a bit of part-time. Moeen is really no much more than a part-timer in T20, and they have Adil Rashid. And it's also, if Adil Rashid does get injured now, you're going in with Liam Dawson as your frontline spinner in a T20 World Cup.
That's the bizarre bit for me. I mean, first of all, it's very strange when you look at India's squad and they picked, 5 spinners? Mm. And England have picked 1 and 2 halves? I mean, that they seem to know something that we don't, or that everyone knows that England haven't picked up on. I think it's a very odd balance to the squad, and I appreciate Freddie's point on the fact that travelling reserves make the makeup of your squad a bit less kind of pertinent, and that you've got those guys there. But to me, even if you go that way, the fact it's Dawson and not Parkinson as your reserve spinner is...
He just doesn't really fancy him, does he?
I mean, that's it. I think on the show, lots of times we've tried to kind of explain away why he hasn't been picked for certain squads and tried to make excuses. They're saving him for something. I think... Whether it's Morgan, or I'm pretty sure it's Morgan, and perhaps Silverwood as well, they just don't seem to fancy him. They seem to think whatever he does for Lancashire is not going to be easily replicated for England. Maybe Morgan just thinks, I can smash him in the nets. Our boys smash him in the nets. That's not going to work. I don't know, but for me, it's baffling he's not there.
Yeah, I guess.
At least in the travelling reserves.
Possibly he's a proper number 11. He's not a great fielder. Maybe that comes into it a little bit. I also think that it's possible that if they encounter a really slow surface that takes a lot of spin, they actually back Moeen and Livingston to be competent second and third spinners and actually get close to 12 overs out of them. possibly. I mean, it must be, otherwise they'd have included more spinners in the squad.
It just feels like they wanted Curran, Wokes and Willie in the squad because they like them all and think they're good cricketers. They just picked them all, even though it's hard to see how all three of them are going to be useful over the course of a tournament. But I'm delighted to see Mills in there. I don't think that's any surprise at all. Morgan was doing some commentary on the 100 when Mills was playing and clearly thinks of him as a really special talent. I think there's a good chance they'd have actually played even if Archer was around. I think maybe he might have snuck in rather than one of the other seamers. He does different things and he does them very, very well. England's death bowling has been a bit wayward at times and he's kind of a specialist in that area. It's interesting. I mean, it seems to take a lot fewer wickets than he used to. And I saw him describing himself as a defensive bowler, which is odd to think of a 90 miles an hour quick as a defensive bowler, but that obviously is how it works in T20 sometimes. And
his economy rate was brilliant in the 100, wasn't it?
Yeah, fantastic. He's got the range of skills that you think will make him successful in international cricket. I think he's a better bowler now than when he got the big IPL deal. He's certainly got a lot more to his game. That's exciting. I think he's got a really good chance of actually not just being in that squad, but obviously being in that squad, but playing.
I was away, wasn't I, for a month or so. So I didn't see the back end of the 100 when Liam Livingstone was tearing it up. And I also wasn't really a part of the editorial decision to put Liam Livingstone on the front cover of the upcoming issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly. Liam Livingstone's made 77 runs in 7 or 8 first-class innings this year and yet carries the cover of the greatest cricket magazine in the world. Joe, talk me through Liam Livingstone in the last 6 weeks, because I'm genuinely fascinated. I've always liked him. I've always liked the rawness, the chutzpah element of his game. I like the fact that he bowls bits of filth around the wicket, back of the hand, all that. And obviously, he's got the fastest hands in the North. What else is there to say about him? How does he justify getting on the front cover of the magazine
it's a bit late since we went to print last week. But...
Pulpit.
I love the cover, by the way, and I completely back Livingstone.
It is a great looking cover.
I think perhaps you had to see it to kind of believe it or be part of it. Some of the hitting during the course of the 100 was extraordinary. Not only the distances, which were obviously eye catching, and 120 meters, everyone gets excited about that. But the regularity with which he was doing it was astonishing. There is also just a kind of sort of unreconstructed nature to the way he bats, which is hugely appealing as well. And there's a newness to him as well. I mean, he's been around for a little while in county cricket. He said he's been a part of a test squad, but there is a newness as a character, which from the point of view of putting together a magazine, I find very appealing. There's also, from a kind of the business angle, we have our subscribers who receive the magazine every month. Hopefully they're not going to be turned off by having him on the cover, although a few might be. But also, we sell on a newsstand in WH Smith's and all other good news agents. And Livingstone is the name that will have grabbed a few people, new fans to the game over the last month or 6 weeks. And if they're thinking about picking up a magazine for the first time, Livingstone will be the name on their lips. So that was another appealing aspect to it.
Considering that what he's done, a lot of it has been on free-to-air TV as well. Yeah. If the 100 has worked as the ECB and we all hope it has, he might well be the most famous, second most famous cricketer in the country at this point. Him or Paul Sterling, I think, who was obviously player of the match in the final.
I remember, Joe, when you told me that when Phil was away, that Phil wasn't as sold on the idea of Livingstone on the cover. I was really surprised, and I genuinely think, Phil, you had to be here whilst he was doing it. I remember one of my friends who never really got into cricket before the tournament said her mum would ask, is Livingstone on? He's never showed any interest in cricket ever before. I think he does just have that almost, I think we just compared him to Peterson before. I'm not saying he's as good as Peterson, but he does have that draw, I think. I think he's very charismatic. I love the energy around Livingstone when he comes out to bat. And like at a very basic level, he just hits the ball so far. It draws people in a way like you can know nothing about cricket and you'd be like, that's cool. I want to know more about
Lords,
that guy.
For the final, the energy was just sucked out of the ground when he got run out in that way, which was a kind of amazing piece of fielding itself. But Lords was just flat after that. It was really, I keep coming back to Peterson. And I think there is a lot of that in him, not necessarily that he's going to go on and score 23, 24 test hundreds, but
there has been that little murmur, right? Which is only a murmur at the moment around him, from what I gather. But and even around this table, it might have been murmured off air that he could yet be that breakout player that crafts his numbers in white ball cricket and emerges into red ball cricket, and he's good enough to see off both. Do you genuinely think... Does one genuinely think that might be the case?
I'll happily murmur it on air.
Right. Okay. But,
hasn't scored 25 in a first-class game in 2 years.
Yeah, sure. But there's a lot of...
average 40-odd before that, right?
Yeah. There was a time when he was a very feasible test prospect. He's been in test squads before. I also think that, I mean, the momentum is with him. I think one thing is, and this is going back a while now, but the Jason Roy experiment... happened in the worst possible place to do that experiment, because those kind of openers just never succeed in England, even when you look at the ones who have done it successfully anywhere. David Warner and Sehwag have 100 between them in England. It's just not something you can't hit the cover off it, hit the shine off it in England.
Cummins and Hazelwood.
Exactly. Where you can do that, if anywhere, is in Australia, where it just doesn't move as much, where it's a different ball, and where you do see these hit through the line openers succeed, like Hayden and Morrison. Obviously, there is a lot to their games. I'm not saying Livingston is as good as those. But if you are going to pick a white ball player who has an incredible eye and is playing in the form of his life anywhere, it is in Australia. And if you just want to change the mood music around the camp after a sort of a drab test summer where you've been like beaten by two teams, you pick the most appealing cricketer in the country. So I think there is a lot to be said for having a look at Livingston and just keeping in mind that could be an option. I think I know that the numbers recently don't speak hugely in his favour, but also that is over such a long period of time at sort of not great times of the season, because when there are CAN championships, a good time of season, he's off doing other stuff. I'm definitely not against the idea of Livingston being a bolter if he continues doing what he has done. It just felt in August like you could turn a TV on at any point and Livingston would be hitting a six, basically. And it was actually not in the 100, it was in the 220
blast game. That was amazing.
And he didn't even make very many runs, but he clearly just got to Taunton, saw how short the boundaries were, saw probably he was in the opposition bowling tag and thought, like, I should probably be hitting every ball for six here, and just basically tried to do that, like swung himself as a feet. Was like
25 off 9 or something like that. Yeah.
It was great. It was one of the best things of the summer, I think.
Yeah, and also I think the stage of a World Cup is so huge that if he has a really good World Cup, like, it will just be...
And yeah, the World Cup being just around the corner was a big part of it. To be honest, I mean, if we're being completely honest, he was lined up to be a cover story for the issue after the one we've just sent to print, which would have been our T20 World Cup preview. As it was, it felt like a compelling story to do now. You know, I mean, if he's won the World Cup for England in 6 weeks, then... it will look like we're ahead of the curve for once.
staying in the world of T20 cricket, the IPL restarts this week.
Really?
In case you'd forgotten, the tournament was roughly halfway through the group phase when it was called off. Delhi, CSK, RCB and Mumbai were in the top four. Sunrisers are rooted to the bottom. KKR are struggling. And Punjab and Rajasthan are just outside the top four. There have been a few withdrawals. Plenty of English withdrawals, actually. Wokes, Bairstow, Butler and Milan are not taking part. A couple of additions. George Garton is now part of the RCB squad. And Adil Rashid is now part of the Punjab Kings, which is exciting. The final England-New Zealand T20I took place a few days ago. England emerged victorious to take the series 2-1. England chased 145 off the penultimate ball of the innings. Heather Knight, returning from injury, hit 42. Sophia Dunkley scored a calm 22 not out at the death, and Amy Jones hit a quick fire 32. Dunkley continuing her fine summer. A bit of news ahead of the ODI series. Charlie Dean has been included. She's not yet played for England yet. She's a 20-year-old offie who played for London Spirit in the 100. Kate Cross and Lauren Winford-Hill both returned to the group, having missed out on the T20I series, while Danny Wyatt is back in the squad, having not played in the ODI series against India earlier in the summer. Before we go on the show, a word for Sixes Cricket Club. We've been recording the podcast over the last few weeks from Sixes Cricket Club every now and again. If you haven't heard about Sixes, Sixes Cricket Club is a new cricket-themed social entertainment venue with restaurant, bar and cricket nets. All Wisden podcast listeners can receive 10% off their food and drink by quoting Wisden10 on their booking notes. They've got a new store open in Manchester, so if you're based in the Northwest, make sure you check it out. Joe, you actually went there over the weekend, not in Manchester. Have a good time.
It was actually went on Friday with a few mates, three of which had basically never played cricket before. Shambolic scenes throughout, really, but glorious fun, excellent food, nice drinks, and the cricket's good.
Did you connect with any?
Yeah, I got 88 not out. It's my highest score in any form of cricket, actually. But I actually found the beginner one that we started on was so slow that I actually struggled on beginner. But when I hit club, my natural level, then yeah, I was clearing the ropes on a regular basis.
Yeah, I often find the bowling I face is just too slow for me. A problem I often have. Before we get into the cricket played in the county game this week, we'll start with the biggest story from the county game. Yorkshire released a statement regarding the investigation into Azeem Rafiq's allegations of racism at the club. Seven of Rafiq's allegations were upheld. I'll run through them. When Rafiq was playing junior cricket for Yorkshire, he was not provided with halal food at matches. This has now been rectified. Prior to 2010, the panel found that there were three separate incidents of racist language being used by former players, which were found to be harassment on the grounds of race. Before 2012, a former coach regularly used racist language. During a second spell at Yorkshire between 2016 and 2018, there were jokes made around religion, which made individuals uncomfortable about their religious practices. During a second spell at the club, a former player made references to Rafiq's weight and fitness that amounted to bullying. In August 2018, when Rafiq raised concerns of racism, there was a failure by the club to follow its own policy or investigate these allegations. On a number of occasions prior to 2018, the club could have done more to make Muslims more welcome within their stadiums and should have dealt better with complaints of racism or antisocial behaviour within those stadiums. In response to that statement, Rafiq, the spokesperson, said, "We note that Yorkshire has confirmed Azeem was the victim of racism and bullying during his two spells at Headingley. However, we must highlight the atrocious way this process continues to be handled. Azeem was not given any notice of this morning's statement. He received a copy only a couple of minutes before the media. Azeem and his team are not in a position to properly understand the club's conclusions and how they reached them because Yorkshire has not provided a copy of the report. This is clearly unacceptable and an abuse of process. What is clear is that Yorkshire admits racism and bullying has taken place on many occasions, yet won't accept the obvious, that this is an institutional problem. We also note that Baroness Morgan, the former Secretary of State for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport, has written to Yorkshire in recent days demanding that Azeem sees a full copy of the report. We further note that the letter to Yorkshire from Julian Knight, the Chair of the Digital, Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee on Wednesday, we welcome their interventions. We will provide a fuller statement in the coming days. Today, Azeem Rafiq says that his allegations against Yorkshire will be told to the world after suggesting he cannot continue his formal dispute with the club." Quite a lot to digest there. Phil, anything to add?
Interesting intervention today by Rafiq, as you mentioned. I don't know if you quoted it. Sorry, it was so much to take in and it just swells the mind. But yeah, he said, "I'm now looking for the right platform to end my pain by speaking out in full with names, dates and every inch of detail." Now, that might be the voice of a man at the end of his tether who's venting on Twitter, or it might be that this is going to be the next point of action for him and his people. There are names who we know. There are names who others know within the game. There's certainly names that now the ECB are aware of. The ECB have not been happy as well with Yorkshire as well, with the way that the report has been obfuscated, held back from the ECB, who only saw it themselves last week. But if Rafiq doesn't blow the cover, then there's every chance that parliamentary privilege will be used by an MP or two to reveal the names of those who are implicated in this. And we understand, we have a degree of understanding why Yorkshire themselves can't, because of the legal ramifications. So we get that, although it doesn't sit comfortably on anybody, I don't think. Certainly outside of the four walls of Yorkshire. And did their statement begin to fully recognise the weight of those findings? I didn't feel that personally. At least they'd moved on from that term inappropriate behaviour, which was thrown at Rafiq 2 or 3 weeks ago, which was beyond the pale, I thought. And he had every right to be incandescent on the back of that. At least now the words have been used. Some of the examples that have been flagged are pretty, turns the stomach. The thing that really jumps out from that list of seven upheld allegations by an independent inquiry, the thing that really sticks out to me, he made these complaints in 2018 and there was a failure to address them, a failure to follow up. Now that, I'm afraid, carries echoes of what happened when Taha, who's a colleague of ours, first spoke to Rafiq about this over 12 months ago, and his story began to creep out into the public domain, amplified by the BBC and Crick Info after the story had run in Joe and Maya magazine. Yorkshire weren't interested in talking to us at that point. They were only prepared to even engage with this scandal when it got too big for them to manage. I'm afraid what we hear from this refusal to acknowledge the allegations in 2018 is a further example of that, and a root cause example. And that, to me, of all of it, that drives home that Rafiq's point about institutional racism in the club, which is a difficult thing to throw around, and I'm not, by the way, I'm not. But the definition of institutional racism is not a million miles away from that idea, that reality, that he came to them and he said, this is what's been happening, multiple examples, multiple people involved, and
there is a pattern, isn't there?
There's
a pattern.
They turned away from it.
A pattern of doing nothing until you're forced into a position where you have to act. And that has been proven at several stages now. So then it's very hard to believe that there actually is the will to change things when you haven't bothered to act until you've been forced into a position where you've had to. And now Yorkshire have to prove to everyone that they do mean what they say, rather than just trying to wriggle out of the stuff they've been accused of, which is what it's felt like all the way through.
And I imagine from Rafiq's point of view, he's gone through a lot and there are no obvious consequences to that. Ben, you made the point when you read the statement that one of the first bullet points about how Yorkshire are moving forward was amending their club handbook.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, just echo everything that Phil and Joe have said. And that, I mean, the ECB have been, I actually don't think they have seen the full report yet. They've only seen the summary. So I think it's very limited who has actually read that full report. And it's limited the ECB's ability to act because they can't take any possible disciplinary measures while there's this investigation and process. And then even though the investigation concluded, they can't see what the conclusions even are properly. So they can't come to decision themselves. Maybe it'll get to the point where they have to do their own investigation because Yorkshire are unwilling to release their findings. I think that there should be very little off the table in terms of sanctions for the club because of how they've handled this whole thing, including suspension from the county championship and the championship and the county game for any number of years, basically. I think it's abhorrent through the whole process.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the list of MPs that you flagged up at the start of that, I don't know if you mentioned Kevin Brennan as well, who Crick Info quoted, and I've got it here, only through openness and transparency will racism in sport be eradicated and more harm will be done to the game of cricket and the club by suppressing any of the report's findings and by making them public and following through on the recommendations. The world is watching really closely now. And meanwhile, the individuals involved, I wonder how well they're sleeping at the moment, because you feel like it's only a matter of time before those names are revealed.
MPs on both sides of the house as well, worth adding.
Poor kid, man.
Mm.
That's what comes through, just poor kid. He's had to stomach all kinds of shit in the last year. Online, offline, middle of the night, wakes up to another torrent of abuse. Horrific.
And it's still ongoing as well. Anyway, moving on to the county championship. At the time of recording, we're nearly halfway through the third round of county championship games since the divisional split. It's not going great for Somerset. They are struggling big time against Lancashire. Bowled out for not many in response to Lancashire's 3-7-3 at Taunton. The Yorkshire-Warwickshire game is an entertaining low scorer. Wokes and Milan playing there. Hampshire Notts is going similarly. Keith Barker, the first seven Nottinghamshire first innings wickets, but unfortunately didn't get all 10. Elsewhere, there was a daddy 100 for Alistair Cook at the Oval. Tim Murta passed 50 wickets in the county championship for the ninth time in his career. And Ben Brown scored his 21st first-class 100. The Sussex wicketkeeper batsman averages 45 in first-class cricket since the start of 2015.
He'd be a good one for our list of uncapped cricketers.
Uncapped cricketers, absolutely. Well, we did a piece on kind of county cricket sort of unheralded stars a few years ago, didn't we? He's one of our five. And yeah, at the time,
21 first class hundreds from a keeper who's been a club 45? Captain for a while. Absolutely. As well.
Over a really long period of time. I know, see, people say, oh, a lot of that's in Division 2, but the one season he was in Division 1, he got 400s. So you can't really do much with that. And you made the point before we went on air where he said it's not been an easy place to bat, with the exception of last week where they broke all sort of records.
It looked quite an easy place to bat last week.
Ben, your moment of the week is from the televised game between Somerset and Lancashire.
Yeah, so it was a weird first day, and it looks like a weird game in general, because Somerset, took two early wickets, I think, and then Luke Wells counter-attacked chancely, but effectively, and then Somerset hit back. And at the end of the day, they scored like 350 runs and were 8 down, so it was quite hot. So Lancashire were clearly ahead, but it was weird how they got there. Tom Abel, at one point, his figures were 3 for 63 off 7 overs. He was going at 9, like Adil Rashid in an ODI, that. Yeah. But the moment itself was Josh Bohannon, who had... So while Luke Wells was sort of racing on the other end, was sort of grafting away, and he just got to 50... And then played it's such a strange dismissal, really, because it was what sort of like a back cut in the air that was caught by the man about sort of like 2/3, 3/4 of the way in, or a bit closer.
I'm not exaggerating when I say I don't think I've ever seen a fielder in that position in a professional game of cricket before. So he's like, neither, he's not on the fence, he's not on one,
but
he's
not on the line, on backward point.
Yeah, kind of. Like or really
slightly more behind square, yeah, possibly.
So, but not a fly slip, because he's too square to be a fly slip.
It's the new position. I'm not just saying this. Like, India did it. Did it in the test match. This peculiar... You're right. It's not on the 45. It's not on square. Yeah. We might have to edit this stuff out. I mean, but yeah, this peculiar new position. It's for the cut where you lean back and you kind of skew it, I think.
So that's what I was thinking. I was really confused, and I genuinely thought it was a mistake that they had someone out there. But when you think about it, the cut shot is quite hard to get down if you really put your hands through it. So I guess it's a wicket-taking position.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, a brilliant bit of captaincy from Tom Abel. But the point was more that I've enjoyed watching Bohannon bat this year. I went up to Old Trafford for a day out of the summer and saw him make a very good 100 in the Roses game, that gave him just enough time to force a win. He's sort of like an efficient, sort of like compact player, so he's not immediately eye-catching. And I think that's because he's got a brilliant first-class record now, but I think that's why he hasn't got as much discussion. He also came through a very, very like packed full of talent Lancashire age group. I think he was in the same cohort as Hamid, Mahmood and Parkinson all around that time. So if you're in there, you're not the one that people are saying, like, keep an eye on this kid. So but I think that's also given him the time to sort of work out his game, to sort of to build up and now to become like the mainstay of Lancashire's batting, basically. But this was basically a moment, you know, cricket writers are looking for something to write about with the test having been cancelled. You're on a suddenly televised game. Nasser and Atherton are commentating on you.
They just need something to talk about, exactly, for the next few days.
If you get to 100, they are going to look at your Cricket Info profile and realise this guy has something of a case. And so to get to 50 and then to get out in that way felt so frustrating. But he did play really well up to that point. He didn't get the bowling that I think Luke Wells got to get away. There was one moment of discomfort against Marchant De Langer, but for the most part he played him pretty well. And I think there's evidence that he can play the quicks as well. You saw a bit of Jonathan Trott on him, Yaz?
So specifically, he's quite a short guy, probably about 5'5". He's got... What the shot where you kind of flick the ball off a good length that's outside off stump through the leg side that Trott played very well. I think it might have been the shot that got him to his first 100 at the Oval. Might be wrong, but that's very Trott-like. I don't think he's...
I'm wary of pushing everyone, yeah, I talk about in this podcast for a selection. That's not what I'm saying, but I don't think it will be long until he is in some sort of conversation. And had he got to 100, then that could have significantly... Yeah. Hasten that process, I suppose.
I get that point. I don't think like he doesn't like time the ball in a particularly natural way that I think catches the eye. So I think, and he's also only got 3 first class hundreds. So I mean, I guess this is the state of English batting that can sometimes be enough.
And he's also not eye catchingly strange either. I mean, everyone in England's top 7, basically, apart from I guess Milan, I suppose, is either they're an aesthetically beautiful player, and not that Milan isn't at some points, but you know, you've got like Pope or something like that, or they like have like loads of moving parts setting. So each of them will catch you on somewhere, whereas Bohannon just kind of bats fairly normally. It isn't a brilliant timer, but has like a secure enough defence and knows how to sort of work around his runs.
Anything else on Josh Bohannon?
No, I mean,
no, we did a good 2-3 on that.
I was just thinking, actually, the Lancashire Academy products get a good reviews from us, don't they? As we said, Parkinson, obviously, Mahmood gets a... Yeah. Hamid, obviously, a long-time favourite.
Yeah, that's true.
Don't know if their combined airtime went up to
Livingston as well.
Yeah, Lauren's got a good 70 out here. And just, I forgot to mention, Gary Balance hit a half century when it was all falling apart for Yorkshire. Yorkshire were 90 for 8 at one point, and Balance had more than 50 runs. Balance yet again averages more than 50 in the county championship this year. So he's doing what he's always done. And a reminder that finals day is this Saturday. Four Southern teams there. It's Hampshire versus Somerset and Kent versus Sussex. Did any of you guys predict any of those four to win?
Did we do predictions for this one?
I can't remember.
Someone would have predicted Sussex, wouldn't we?
I always predict Sussex every year.
Kent have rested loads of players for it, haven't they? From the county championship.
They rested Darren Stevens in this round of games.
Fair enough that he needs a rest.
Yeah. He doesn't want to rest though, does he? If he stops, he might not be able to start again. That's the key. Keep him going.
That's true. Moving on. In the Rachel Hayho Flint Trophy, Georgia Elwes scored an unbeaten 112 yesterday to help the Vipers to the second highest total of the summer. It was an amazing game, actually, because the Vipers scored 309. And they ended up winning by just one run. Fran Wilson's 51 ball, 65 out wasn't quite enough for her side. Elwes, after scoring that 100, defended 9 off the last over of the game. There are 3 runaway sides at the top of the table. The Northern Diamonds, the Vipers and the Central Sparks all have 5 wins from 6. Moving on to the international game, Afghanistan's proposed test against Australia this winter is in doubt. Last week, Cricket Australia released a statement saying, if recent media reports that women's cricket will not be supported in Afghanistan are substantiated, Cricket Australia would have no alternative but to not host Afghanistan for the proposed test match due to be played in Hobart. In response, the Afghanistan Cricket Board released a statement saying, since the ACB joined the ICC and through our fast growth through affiliate, associate and to full membership, the ICC has been aware of our cultural and religious environment. It has taken a balanced, diplomatic, sensitive and considerate approach as we have worked to develop every aspect of the game of cricket in our country, despite the situations we have faced. We believe that the ICC has had the forethought to recognise and accept that we have been doing all we can to grow cricket in the traditional cultural, religious and challenging political environment of our country. The alternative to cancellation of the test match would be for CA to take the same approach as the ICC. A considered, balanced cricket diplomacy would be far more productive for Afghanistan and for cricket than a sudden knee-jerk reaction. Cricket Australia needs to know that the comments of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan spokesperson regarding women's participation in cricket are not substantially different to the ACB's cultural and religious environment during the democratically elected Karzai and Ghani governments of the last 20 years. We believe that the ICC is fully aware of this, although it seems that Cricket Australia is not. I mean, it's not a very straightforward situation at all.
Not an easy pod, this one, is
no,
it?
No, it's not. It's not, no. But we're going to get to the Cameroon Mancads in a bit, so that'll restore some balance.
We've got a good bit of Mancad chat. That'll be uncontroversial.
There's a very, very good video of Australian cricket writer Gideon Haig arguing that cricket has more influence if it retains a link with Afghanistan cricket. He's also quite critical of the ICC in that they're basically an events management body that is ill-equipped to make decisions as serious as this. But I completely see the merits of both points of view. It's very, very complicated.
Yeah, it is so tough. I mean, my natural inclination is that they should be allowed to continue to play, because we've seen the players emerge. It's one of the what is cricket's greatest story of the last 20 years, probably. And for that to just suddenly disappear doesn't bear thinking about. But then we have seen in the past, I mean, you look back at apartheid South Africa, players have had to effectively sacrifice part of their careers, their international careers, in order for the greater good. The problem there, I think, sporting boycotts actually hurt South Africa. I mean, that the South African government want to be playing international sport against these other countries. I'm not sure by boycotting Afghanistan cricket, that's going to hurt the Taliban. I don't think they care in the slightest. So I'm not really sure that is going to do anything proactively good. That still doesn't necessarily mean that you should just kind of line up and play them, though. That is also problematic. I think it's interesting, the ICC, I think they're not meeting until, is it halfway through October or even November to discuss this? So it's after the T20 World Cup has started. So it seems very likely, unless anything changes, which it obviously is a changing situation, that Afghanistan will be in that T20 World Cup. And it would feel harsh in the extreme to strip them of that right at such short notice at this point. So my view would be, get through that World Cup, let them play, and then I guess try and figure it out from there. But I think in principle, I agree with Gideon Hayes' point that you're better off engaging with Afghanistan cricket than just letting it wither and die.
Moving on, Joe, what's your moment of the week?
Well, obviously it was at Selhurst Park on Saturday afternoon, but I presume you want something vaguely related to cricket. Yeah, yeah. Sure. It was on the way into work this morning, listening to Mikey Holding's Desert Island Discs, which was, I've still got two songs to go actually, but it's been absolutely joyous so far. It's lovely hearing him and Lauren Laverne talking.
Two of the great accents.
Yeah. And also two people that I listen to so much that it's, but you never think you'd hear them talking together. It's like when you kind of introduce two friends from different groups and then you see them getting on in the pub and it's just the night.
This is really weird.
Can I ask, before you get onto the songs, and I want to know, has Lauren got much sensibility for the game?
I think she has, or she put it on really well. She talked about watching videos of him, obviously in her research for the show, and seeing him come in off his long run. And that she definitely, if she didn't have a feel for it, she gave a really good impression that she did.
That's lovely.
And they absolutely got on. You could absolutely tell that. So it was, I heartily recommend it. But what struck me, and this was news to me, others might have heard this, but that this is his last year as a commentator, Michael Holding. She said that at the start very casually.
I did not know that.
I think maybe she's kind of jumped the gun perhaps there, or that's, but that does, I've spoken to another couple of people since who were expecting that, which I guess would mean he's done his last test match in England, which would be a very sad way for it all to finish. But anyway, the Desert Island Disc is, I'm sure a lot of our listeners would have already listened to it, but absolutely worth a listen. So yeah, there's
what's the standout?
Well, Marvin Gaye, What's Going On.
Nice.
You've got Bob Marley, War, you know, the song where it's based on the lyrics from Haile Selassie's speech.
Both politically engaged tunes, of course.
Yeah. Dionne Warwick, Don't Make Me Over, which he...
Don't know if I know that
one. No, I don't. I kind of recognise the song, but I didn't know it by title. Yeah, and he tells stories that a lot of cricket fans will have already heard, particularly last summer and the kind of impromptu speech. But there's a lot of lighter stuff in there as well. And yeah, it's just a joy listening to the two of them chatting away.
It's really sad if he's not going to commentate.
Yeah, and as I say, I mean, it was said on the show, so I assume it is true, but that there's certainly been no kind of fanfare around it so far. So hopefully, I mean, I can't imagine him going around the outfield like Henry Blofeld did a few years ago. I don't think that's really his style anyway, but he certainly deserves a proper send-off if that is to be the end of his commentary over here.
Absolutely. Phil, what's your moment of the week?
You tell me, yes.
Well, I was coming to bowl. I think it was my fifth over, last ball of my fifth over.
Yeah, hold on. That's not what game it is. Got to set the scene. So this was a Wisden 11, select 11, in as much as we managed to get 11 people on the field.
Which we did.
Against a select 11 of under 15s from the MCC Foundation hubs. Hubs being these hubs set up around the country, of which there's 60-odd, I think. And this was the Southeast region. And they are set up for state school kids who show real promise and talent in the game to try and develop their game with professional coaching. So it's a really great scheme. We played against them on Thursday last week at Hampton Wick Royale CC. Take it away.
Well, first of all, they were brilliant. They were so good. Every single bowler they had was so skillful. I couldn't believe how pretty much all of them had multiple slower ball variations and they all worked. And their batsmen, we only saw five of them, they all looked class. And they absolutely thumped us.
However,
the last ball of my fifth over with the new ball, we were playing with the pink ball, just back for length, moved away a little bit, drew the outside edge, and then Phil at first slip took a diving catch, but diving catch forward, which I think is less eye-catching, but probably more impressive than the more instinctive one where you go out wide. That was my moment of the week and probably yours too.
Moment of the year, Joe?
It was a special moment. Well, I was going to say as well, so it was a 40-over game, so you would expect your bowlers to get eight apiece. Yaz has gone through his first seven off the reel, ready to come on for his eighth, and then it emerges that the rules have actually been set. Phil wasn't listening at the toss as our captain, that you only had seven overs per bowler. And I mean, if you listen to this regularly, you'll know Yaz is a nice, mild-mannered man at the most times.
Not then.
He was furious, still remonstrating with the umpire, even after the drinks break, trying to get that over.
No, I was just clarifying if it was seven overs in a row or
pointedly
seven overs overall.
Yeah, yeah. I would say. Yeah.
Well, anyway, it was a really, really fun day out.
It was. And, you know, in amongst all the nonsense of the last few weeks, the sort of head spinning nonsense, there was something quite magical, I thought, felt about that afternoon, you know, seeing the next generation come through, play us off the park. But yeah, they know the game inside out as well, these lads. And yeah, it was a rare kind of moment of poetry in a very sort of prose heavy month, I would say.
Phil's run out on 49. Very much not his fault at all. Ian Sykes calling through for a single. Never a single on. Ball bounce very comfortably into the short cover's hand and run out by
not
quite a distance.
Not what we needed at that point not, as well.
Absolutely not.
After being reduced to 24 for 5, yeah. I think, at one stage. Anyway.
That was good fun. bit of good fun elsewhere. Ben, do you want to explain what happened in the Cameroon game yesterday?
Yes. So this was in the ICC Regional Women's Africa T20 qualifier. So Cameroon were actually making their debut in the T20i format against Uganda. They had their debut delayed slightly by, I think, possibly a COVID scare, maybe, or they waiting for some tests to come back. But their first game had been pushed back, and they made quite the announcement. So Mava Duma, or MF Duma, if you go by her initials, 16 years old, according to Crick Info, effected 4 runouts of the backing up non-striker in the same innings. So 2 in the 16th over, I think, and then 2 in the 20th over, mancads, if you're not familiar with that description, which was just remarkable. There was I think the best was the umpire's reaction to the third, because there was sort of like a little shrugged raise of the hands just before raising his finger, sort of like cut, like a bit of like almost like this sort of isn't on, but also like really what is the third batter doing at that point, having seen the first two players be mancadded, to then also be like, yeah, I don't really need to worry about this backing up, because it's not like they were sprinting out of their crease. They were just sort of like the Uganda batters were just had their bat sort of kind of lazily trailing behind them, and then were utterly caught out. And then Uganda are a pretty decent side at that level. They've been at the global qualifiers before, have come not too far from qualifying for the main thing. So they weren't quite comfortable, and Mava Duma was eventually part of a hat trick herself. So
I enjoyed the, I think it was the fourth one actually, the fourth of them, as a fielder sprinted over and they did chest bumps.
Yes, after the celebrations. Yeah, amazing. Yeah.
Well, they said there were hearty celebrations after every single wicket.
Yeah, and why not? I mean, it's valuable scalps. I feel like there are two little bits that could easily have been your moments of the week, but obviously getting out a 14-year-old is much more important. Rashid Khan stepped down as Afghanistan's T20i captain 22 minutes after their squad was announced for the T20 World Cup, confirming him as their captain. So he saw that come out, watched an episode of Friends, and then he wasn't consulted apparently about the choice of squad, which is why he wasn't happy. And Brendan Taylor has retired. He's playing his last ODI as we speak.
I read that
one
this
of
morning,
Zimbabwe's
yeah.
greatest ever.
And Ryan Tendershata too.
Yes. Yes.
Who announced his retirement yesterday. Hopefully I'll be talking to him at Chelmsford next week. One of the great county careers, really.
I was going to say we should get him on the show. Get a few words on from him for next week.
And good he's part of Netherlands' T20 World Cup squad as well at the age of 41, which is very cool. Which is a pretty good way to
one of the all-time greats.
I thought you were going to mention the dog incident in the All-Ireland women's Cup semi-final, where a dog ran onto the field and took the ball, basically, and it's all on video, and you've got the dog owner who looks like a teenager chasing the dog and the dog goes to the batter, and the batter then just gets on her knees and starts stroking the dog, which is very nice.
Lovely.
You can find that on the internet.
I tell you what, from Josh Bohannon onwards, this was really, you know, really lightened up
a little bit.
And then one bit of news from the international game that we haven't touched on yet is South Africa and Sri Lanka are currently going through a T20i series in Sri Lanka. South Africa 2-0 up. Keshav Maharaj has captained South Africa in both games, having never played a T20i before.
The George Bailey. Yeah.
Yeah, the George Bailey. Markham's having a pretty good series with bat and ball, actually. He scored 48 in the first game and took a 3 for in the second.
And Maharaj took a wicket with his first ball, I think.
Did he? So
his first ball of his career as captain, and he takes a wicket.
Who writes his scripts?
Yeah. Absolutely. Joe, as mentioned earlier, there's a new Wisden Cricket Monthly out this week. What do people have to look forward to?
Yes, as mentioned before, Liam Livingstone is the cover story, even if Phil didn't want it so.
hey.
Supposed to be selling it, come on.
No, I think Phil would come to agree by the end of it all. But that's the cover story. What else have we also got? Taha did a really good piece looking at the kind of history of England national selectors. also with an eye on the fact that they've abolished the role and Chris Silverwood's doing the whole job. So he spoke to Jeff Miller, McNeil, Angus Fraser about some of the players they identified immediately as someone they had to pick. Ian Bell, James Anderson popped up unsurprisingly. And also Newell kind of calls into question the modern way, thinks there's too much on Silverwood's shoulders, which I think from discussions we've had amongst ourselves, most of us would agree with that too. We have got
Javed Miandad's Cricket Life. Brilliant interview with one of the greats, one of the all-timers. So that's well worth picking up as well, but done by Saj Sadiq.
Yeah, I interviewed Lisa Kightley, England women head coach, about a kind of tricky, so it's almost 2 years since she took the job. Obviously, it's not. She did actually admit if she knew COVID was around the corner, she might not have taken this job. But she does still seem to be enjoying it despite that. And she speaks quite kind of forcefully about the women's 100. And she basically said she thinks England are pretty much caught up with Australia now, which was one of the main reasons she took the job in the first place. She saw that gap starting to narrow. Phil?
Andy Zaltzman tells you all about the number 99. Andrew Miller tells you all about why English cricket stuck back in the 1990s. Lizzie Ammon tells you all about the championship restructuring for next year. And Lawrence Booth tells you what Yorkshire's muted response to those allegations amounts to. While I actually got angry with Tom Harrison and his cohort at the top of the ECB for that 2.1 million bonus that they've appeared to have awarded themselves in the midst of a game going through a pandemic and financially on its knees.
Mm.
That makes me feel pretty uncomfortable. So yeah, even I was moved to anger this month, believe it or not.
And on the county side of things, got the county files, so all 18 counties covered, plus Tanya Aldred has gone and looked back at Lancashire's 2011 County Championship win on its 10th anniversary, speaking to Glenn Chappell, Simon Kerrigan, about the kind of weirdness of that year, because you might remember that Old Trafford wasn't available to them because they were switching the pitch round, so they were playing most of their home games at Liverpool. And just memories of that year after so many years of expecting to win it, this year where no one really kind of thought they had a chance, and then finally this young team of homegrown products pulled it off. And there's more Lancashire for you just to round things up.
And finally, Ted Dexter as well. I'd do my best to try and send him off as best I could. One of the all-time greats. And I managed to interview a few months ago. He was still getting stuff done, even into his final months. Released a book in October last year, which was really well received. There are some lives that are barely comprehensible for the vastness of it. And Lord Ted's was one of them. So I did my best to try and capture some of that essence as well.
As always, you can get the magazine at wisdom.com/shop. Just before we finish, a thought about Miller's piece comparing England to England in the 90s. Yesterday, Sky were showing part of the Fletcher years documentary, and Duncan Fletcher was asked about the England team that he inherited. And I don't think he said this without much thought. He said that he'd really thought about the England team that he was taking over. And he said he thought England should easily have been the number one side in the world in the 90s, which was quite interesting. And he kind of listed all the players and said, how could you not be with this group of players? And he said it was down to poor management, which I thought was quite interesting, given that he inherited a team that was rock bottom.
Yeah, and then turned them into a really good one. I mean, yes. I think there's an element of, look what I did here, folks. Yeah, I think maybe Warren and McGrath may have had one or two things to say about that.
Yes.
But
yeah.
Certainly they should have done better.
I'd recommend the Fletchers.
They are brilliant.
I think you can watch it on the Sky Sports website or Sky Go, one of the two.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all we have time for on today's show. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Joe. Cheers, Ben. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends, and we'll be back next week.